Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. This week, Martin Summers and I, as you may have noticed, have been taking a step back from the news review, taking a much longer view of politics and economics and history. We've been doing a bit of a world tour of economics and history, but Martin, you did PPE at Oxford. Now, one of the big parts of that, of course, is philosophy. Tell us about the roots of philosophy in the Greek world, because I think that's where we have to start, am I right?
I think so. Philosophy is a Greek word, meaning love of wisdom. And the Greeks are credited with the creation of the Western philosophical tradition. Of course, there are other philosophical traditions around the world.
Now, that's also, I suppose, over the span of thousands of years, sort of competed, hasn't it, with the biblical worldview. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think the biblical worldview evolved later than the philosophical worldview. There was a mutual interaction once the two were up and running.
I mean, is it fair to say that there's a little bit of common ground between the two, or is it mostly?
Well, I mean, whenever anybody's speculating about, you know, the meaning of life and so on, then there's bound to be a bit of common ground, isn't there?
Okay. Is there anything that you'd like to point to, any particular Greek philosophers that have had a really massive impact, rather than, you know, maybe a little impact?
Well, the obvious ones to point out are Plato and Aristotle. Who were contemporaries. They overlapped, at least.
Amazing, really, to think that, you know, two people that actually lived at the same time. What years are we talking about?
Oh, you know, just try me now. I think we're talking about the 300s BC.
Right. So who were these guys, and what was their influence?
Well, I mean, they weren't the only ones. There was a general explorescence of people speculating about the nature of life.
So they're doing a bit of reflection, a little bit like we're trying to do here.
Well, the main point about Greek philosophy, which made it different, was that they tried to start guessing about the nature of life without relying on mythical stories. So the philosophers were known in their era for being very sceptical about stories about gods and goddesses and so on, which had very much been the staple mechanism for thinking about these things before they'd come along.
Didn't they come a cropper with the Greek authorities? Because, of course, you know, there were Greek gods, there were Roman gods, and, you know, these were to be worshipped.
Well, Socrates was eventually forced to commit suicide by the Athenian democracy because...
Hang on. Really? Forced to commit suicide?
Well, that was the sentence that he was given, and he could have left. But he chose not to.
Sounds a bit cheeky to say your sentence is to commit suicide. Well, what if he doesn't want to?
Well, he chose to do so, which is again is interesting. If this is the story as we are told it, of course. He in fact had every opportunity to leave Athens if he'd wanted to, and that's what most people expected him to do. But instead, he stayed and actually committed suicide.
Well, in a way,
which of course made everybody feel really bad.
And he was sticking to his principles, was he?
Yes, I mean that's obviously how it's regarded by those who lionized Socrates.
So what were his principles?
Well, Socrates' principles is fairly simple, really. The unexamined life is not worth living. In other words, you should question everything, and don't presume you know anything. And, of course, that radical scepticism is at the root of the philosophical project, and that's what makes it different from any religious project, for example.
Okay, what about Aristotle, then?
Well, Aristotle, Plato, and the difference between Plato and Aristotle, Plato believed that there was a universal form behind everything. So, in other words, he was the ancestor of the idea of what you might call idealism, the idea that ideas create the physical world. So Neoplatonism in the Roman period was a kind of a mixture. Porphyry was the main exponent of that. It was a kind of mixture between the theological ideas of St. Paul and the philosophical ideas of Plato. So the idea that the good and God are the same, for example, all of which seemed to make sense to people in that era. Aristotle was more of a hands-on scientist in modern terms, didn't believe that there were big ideas, that there were lots of small ideas, and small ideas, you know, are more important than having big ideas, because it's all the devil's in the detail. So Aristotle wrote, you know, long books about all sorts of different kinds of animals, for example, and tried to categorize them, which was the first attempt. You know, Aristotle was the first scientist, is what some would say. Well, Plato was still operating at a sort of what you might call a more metaphysical level.
Now, up until, you know, relatively recently, we're talking about maybe 100 years or so, there was this idea of something called natural philosophy. Yeah. Now, is that what we would also now, we now just simply called science?
Yes. Effectively, yes. I mean, and before the philosophy and science sort of separated as science became a more, as science became a more complex discipline, it separated itself off from philosophy. And you now find some scientists that claim that there's nothing much they can learn anymore from philosophy. I'm not sure they're right, but philosophy has become a more abstract, less practical matter than it used to be, because philosophy used to be about understanding the world, which could have mean understanding the mind of God or understanding, how physics works.
Now, I mean, I was a grammar school student and I studied A-level physics back in the late 1970s, and my tutor, Mr. Black, fantastic, he gave us a half a lesson, completely unofficial, on the philosophy of science, and his main aim there was to say to us, don't trust scientists. Check it for yourself, because scientists are very, very good at saying that something is true and trying to rationalise something because it's their theory. Actually, it's all theory. And is that fair to say?
Well, I would say that is the scientific view. The existing corpus of scientific theory that we now have is absolutely up for falsification. No doubt it will be falsified.
Well, I mean, you know, one example is this whole thing of climate science. I mean, there is quite an assault on people who doubt it, calling them climate deniers, this kind of thing. Now, that doesn't seem to me to fit very well with this idea of science being a theory which sort of unfolds into society.
At the same time, conceptually, what you have got at any one time, Thomas Kuhn talks about this, is a paradigm of a particular kind. Say, for example, the climate change theory, just as a for example. Now, what you've usually got is a majority that goes along with the existing paradigm and a minority of scientists who don't. And that's the normal practice. But we generally say that the majority provide the paradigm and others rebel against it. Now, what happens over time, as long as we keep asking questions, this is the fundamental point about science as opposed to, say, religious revelation.
But there is
something, all questions, everything is constantly being questioned.
I mean, for example, with the MMR vaccine and the questions of whether it may cause autism, there has been a really definite attempt by the pharmaceutical industry and by the government to say that debate is over.
Yes, but I mean, what you're talking about there is the sociology of power relations, what Foucault, the social scientist, called power knowledge. We've always got a situation where people want certain outcomes of any particular social contest, whether it's a scientific debate or a political election, and they're always trying to spin their stuff so that it gets through and everybody else so that it doesn't. Now, of course, ultimately, scientists are as prone to human weakness as anybody else, and they will go to the barricades to defend a dead theory, well, provided it's their theory.
In some ways, more than ever, of course, scientists are also funded by the industry. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is a massive industry.
Sure, so you can ask yourself a question, well, why is it they're saying this? And I think this is where social science comes back into its own, because it's basically looking at the sociology of why certain things are funded and other things are not. I mean, basically, most scientists are paid by the powers that be to come up with solutions to problems that the powers that be want solved. Therefore, they're not basically spending a lot of time thinking about other things, because that's not where the money is.
Okay, but are those solutions what the people want or what big business wants?
No, of course, scientists are paid workers like everybody else. They tend to do what they're told to do. And so, for example, if you think about GM crops, for example, a lot of the people, the scientists involved in the development of GM crops, just see it as a technical matter. We're just trying to create crops which will create more create more output. And you point out, but the social effects of what you're doing is to undermine small farmers. This is what Vandana Shiva was suggesting. She's a physicist, but an environmentalist based in India. And actually, what the effect of your green revolution revolution stroke genetically modified revolution is to give power to the seed companies, the large farmers, the government, and the small farmers, in fact, actually lose out under this. But the scientists said, well, that's nothing to do with us. That's just politics. Now, in actual fact, everything's connected to everything else. And the problems that scientists are set to solve by society are the problems set by the elite. So, for example, we develop an atom bomb far quicker than we develop, I don't know, a cure for cancer. Because what do the power elite want? Well, they want an atom bomb and they want it now. Cure for cancer? Well, we can do that tomorrow.
One of the things you sort of reminded me there of is what we were talking about in the first hour, that there's this sort of, that is to say, with land rights, is that we were talking about them talking about land improvement. Now, you know, looking at it from a financial point of view, there's more productivity from the land, but the social consequences of creating a massive landless population of peasants sleeping in ditches isn't included in that improvement.
Well, that's a classic example of where people, and of course economists think of themselves as scientists as well, so they talk about improvement being, yes, but this is a very inefficient system, let's get rid of it and have a more efficient system. But of course the losers are still the losers. The Luddites, for example, are absolutely right to resist the imposition of machinery on their industry, because from their point of view, those people and their children definitely did die of starvation because of the introduction of the machinery. Now, you could argue that in the long run, the introduction of machinery was better for all concerned. Now, that's an argument I'm willing to accept. But don't presume that it's in the short run, those who are displaced are going to be better off, because they're not. And if they're not going to be better off, they're going to resist. It's perfectly natural. It's human nature. Somebody comes and takes something off you that you've got, you're going to defend it, aren't you?
Well, the Luddites really have got a lot of echoes in the modern world, because certainly in the 1970s and 80s, with the IT revolution, the technological revolution, robotics, there was a promise of, wow, this is going to really release up humanity with massive amounts of leisure time. The opposite has happened. The total opposite has happened. People have got less leisure time than ever now.
Yes, and that, of course, is the root cause of the economic crisis, is that the system, the capitalist system, is actually immensely productive and finds all the time new ways of producing more stuff, but it's not capable of redistributing that wealth in such a way that everybody benefits. And this of course then leads to people borrowing money to make up for the fact that they're not any better off, and that can go on for quite a while, and then the debt mountain crashes and the whole system goes into crisis, which is where we are now. But of course the root of this is technological change, which has not been integrated into the social structure.
Well, I would point out at this time, there is a website which was set up last year called The Luddites at 200, for the 200th anniversary of the Luddites. And I mean, I must admit, I have a lot of sympathy for people who look at the smartphones and a lot of the technology that's around nowadays, Martin. I don't know if you agree, and say, well, this is actually a bit of a curse, isn't it? You know, you've got the dependency on this stupid thing. But anyway, their strapline is for action against technology hurtful to commonality.
Yes, but it's. I think the point is hurtful to commonality. I mean, I don't think being opposed to technology makes much sense at all. I mean, we've always been technical creatures. If you look at the kind of technology that was being used in the Stone Age, it's pretty sophisticated. And we've always been technical.
Was it?
Well, yes, far more sophisticated than any other creatures used. You know, if you think about...
What kind of technology were they using in the Stone Age?
Well, for example, the complex bow used in the Mesolithic, which is after the Paleolithic and before the Neolithic, so in other words, before farming, the complex bow that the farmers were using there was never bettered as a weapon or as a tool until the steppe nomads reinvented the complex bow in some thousands of years later.
So this was basically, I suppose, I'm guessing here, but this was a piece of wood that was carved, and then there was the flint arrowheads they used to stick on the end of it.
No. The bow itself is actually not just one piece of wood. That's why it's called a complex bow. And of course the steppe nomads developed a bow which was made partly of horn, partly of wood, and you're actually using the different tensile strengths of the different things you're putting in the bow to make it stronger. So in actual fact, a complex bow, as used in the Mesolithic or as used by the Huns, for example, could probably shoot 400 metres. And that kind of weapon, firearms were unable to reach 400 metres until, middle of the 18th century. So these bows were, in fact, more sophisticated as weapons than a musket. But they were invented in the Mesolithic, thousands of years earlier.
Just going back to this Luddite website, the address is www.luddites200.org.uk. They say the Luddites were textile workers in Nottinghamshire, Yorkshire and Lancashire, skilled artisans whose trade and communities were threatened by a combination of machines and other practices that had been unilaterally imposed by the aggressive new class of manufacturers that drove the Industrial Revolution. And they go on really to detail how a lot of this was to do with who actually owned this technology. And isn't that really the same question we're up against today, that it's the owners of the technology?
Exactly. The point is not the technology, it's the power relationships. That's the problem. And of course, I don't think that we can just say that technology is neutral, because it isn't neutral. Technology tends to serve the interests of the powerful, because it's the powerful who decide what problems the technologists are setting out to solve. So it even begins at the very beginning of the process, where so what problems do we want to solve here? So, for example, there's a lot more money spent in our world trying to solve the diseases of super wealthy people living out the last few years of their lives in comfort than that would be spent on basic help for people who are poor.
That's because
the poor have got no social...
Well, it's also true now that, that the young people have got, it seems, almost no clout whatsoever. One of the forgotten generations are the 18 to 25-year-olds in Britain now.
It's not just in Britain, it's all over the world. And, of course, that's extremely dangerous for the status quo, because these are the military-age males. And if you create a situation where those people have no options and no future, then, generally speaking, nasty outcomes can be guaranteed.
Well, isn't that part of it, that actually the tacit suggestion here is, why don't you just join the military, boys and girls?
Well, no, the question is, what military are we talking about? I mean, the gang culture in Britain and in the US and elsewhere, Colombia and so on, that is the spontaneous creation of military units, if you like. So it's not just a question of joining the army will solve the problem. What you've got is a society where if you don't provide, especially young males, with constructive outlets for their natural tendencies, then they're going to find destructive outlets for them. And that's just the way it is.
Now, we did start by talking about philosophy. Do you want to take us on a bit from the Greeks to the next important generation of philosophers?
Well, I mean, the Greeks dominated the philosophical thinking for hundreds of years.
And they probably still do they?
Well, I mean, the ideas of the Greek philosophers still remain relevant today, surely. But, I mean, in the 19th and 20th centuries, new philosophers began to emerge because the society had changed so radically that, you know, you needed to have some different ideas compared to the ones that had gone before.
And what about democracy? Because this is a great idea. It's the Greek for the people rule. The idea of democracy was supposed to have started in Greece. We're in this strange situation now where Greece is one of the least democratic countries in Europe, now being run by Goldman Sachs.
Well, yes, but I mean, that's to do with the whole development that's happened in the intervening centuries. I mean, philosophy remains important because what philosophy is about is just having clear thinking. When you make a statement, it shouldn't, for example, be self-contradictory, things of that sort.
Now, the trouble is, though, that, I mean, we started off this whole discussion by talking about how little clear thinking there is in communicating the economic crisis to the public.
Well, that's partly because there's a deliberate tendency in the economics profession to obfuscate what they're saying, because they are a new priesthood, effectively, and that they are actually a mathematical priesthood. So the people behind the economic crisis tend to have a very mathematical approach to the subject of economics, and they see it all as a technical matter, and that with their big brains and their big computers that they can solve. But of course, in actual fact, in the real world, it's not actually as simple as that. It's more complicated than that, and they are oversimplifying at the same time as trying to pretend that they are making it so that it's so complicated that they can't explain it.
Now, do the city really have their tentacles in our universities then?
Absolutely. Who do you think pays for economics departments in universities? It's big financial firms and so forth, and they provide the money for these chairs and so on and so forth. There's a conveyor belt. What's beginning to happen in economics departments around the country, I believe Manchester is in the forefront of this, is that students of economics are now demanding that the subject should be widened out to include what are effectively non conventional views and ideas. Now, in actual fact, that used to be the case. Economics departments in my day, back in the 70s, did in fact have a widespread of views within them. But what's happened since then is a narrower and narrower curriculum has been imposed based around these neoliberal free market ideas, which imploded in 2008. You'd have thought at that point they'd have to take a step back, as the Queen famously said. Why didn't anybody predict this? And the reason why nobody predicted this, she was at the London School of Economics, is because the theory had just become too narrow, too ideological, and they were too much, you know, self-referential. And that's why they failed. But in actual fact, there are other ways of looking at the economy. There are institutional approaches, neo-Keynesian approaches, Marxist approaches to looking at the economy, which are not in the mainstream, but they weren't being taught to students. So when the crisis comes, I mean, don't forget, what was being taught in universities before 2008 is that capitalism couldn't have a crisis. It was impossible. And then the thing just happens. And at that point, the theory, if we're talking about science, at that point, the theory should be junked and people should go back to first principles. But don't forget the social power of the social groups which benefit from the current setup is so large. Once you've got the government to bail out your failure, you're then off the hook and you can carry on doing what you did before, which is exactly what's happened. The last 5 years have been wasted. They were the 5 years in which we should and could have actually turned the situation round. But by bailing out the wealthy classes, which is effectively what's happened, they've got complacent. They've presumed that it's all right and all they need to do is go back to business as usual. That's why we're going to have a second and much bigger crisis.
Well, it does sound like a failure of philosophy. I mean, admittedly, the universities are elite institutions and they're not necessarily going to be the greatest sort of fertile ground for philosophy. But you mentioned...
Well, it's a failure of the economics departments to stop talking about philosophy. The PPE, when it was originally set up, politics, philosophy and economics, was set up in 1918. And the idea was, because the kind of people that were sent to the top of the civil service or to run big companies or whatever, they generally did Greek or Latin or both classics. And at the end of the First World War, it was felt, well, actually, that's not really a terribly useful training for people who are going to be running the country. So they invented politics, philosophy and economics to train the people who would run the country in the kind of things that they would need to know. And that didn't mean learning Latin verbs.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Marx. That's what the next thing I wanted to do, because, I mean, I'm fascinated by Marx. A lot of it, I think, is a bit too dogmatic. But, I mean, has Marx been proved right?
I think Marx's views on the economy have actually proved most enduring of all.
Okay, so can we see Marx actually playing out as being a bit of a prophet?
Well, I mean, the fact is that the capitalist system has evolved in pretty much the way that he predicted it would. It's just taken a lot longer than he thought. When he was writing it in the 1840s, he saw capitalism as a kind of time-bound system that would come into existence, would revolutionise the means of production, create its own gravedigger in the sense of creating a society that was better educated but was lacking in all of its needs being fulfilled.
Well, that's true today, isn't it?
Well, don't forget that when Marx was writing, capitalism was in fact in its infancy. So he was predicting that it was going to die quickly and be replaced by a different kind of setup.
When was that?
Well, we're talking about the 1840s, yeah? So he certainly bought into what you were talking about earlier about how the feudal classes had been overthrown by a more merchant-oriented elite in the 1640s in Britain and so on. But he saw that elite would itself be supplanted by a working-class-led revolution. Now, all of this, I think, was speculative. And also, he was thinking, what we were taught in the 1970s was that, yes, capitalism had been a rather unstable and dogmatic system, but we'd now managed to transform and change it, and we now lived in market societies, which were not capitalist in the old-fashioned sense. They had, for example, most major countries, developed countries, had about 50% state and 50% private enterprise, and that was the norm in the 70s.
I mean, surely that is exactly what happened in Russia and China. There was a revolution.
Yes, but it was in the wrong place from a Marxist point of view. The whole conception of Marxism, the original conception, was that you couldn't just have utopian societies, that ultimately... You can only improve society if the technology is developed to do it. So the idea that if we all just shared out the land and lived like medieval peasants, we'd all be happier, Marx was definitely opposed to that idea. He saw capitalism, if you read the Communist Manifesto, the chapter on capitalism is an extremely, you know, he was very positive about capitalism in many ways. He saw it as a very, very necessary stage of human development.
He was saying essentially that capitalism was necessary to develop a great technology which would then be democratised to everyone.
Absolutely. That's the fundamental conception of Marxism, is that it's rooted in the technology. It's not rooted in a moral demand for a better society. He saw that as essentially atavistic, looking to the past. That these demands were not just moral demands; they were rooted in the possibilities of the new technologies that were just coming on stream as he was writing. Now, of course, his tendency was to see all this. I mean, this what's not very good about reading Marx after this period is this idea that progress was inevitable, because everybody believed that at that stage, that human society progressed, and that even through struggle and war and violence, things were getting better. I don't think at the 21st century we can look at it like that. Basically, just about anything can happen. We could be hit by an asteroid tomorrow and the whole of our civilization could be destroyed. We could make all kinds of mistakes. There's no necessary progress. What there is increasing complexity. There's always increasing complexity until, of course, you know, if we get hit by an asteroid, that's the end of the complexity. But, I mean, in the 19th century, everybody believed in progress, and Marx, just like others, believed in progress as well. He didn't believe in votes for women, for example. Well, that's because that was very much part of his generation's way of looking at the world.
Well, certainly one of the big changes I remember, I think probably had the biggest influence on me was watching Adam Curtis's series, which was called The Century of the Self. It was to do with the massive growth in the whole public relations industry. And yeah. I mean, we've done on our programme, on this programme, previous months and years, we've had quite a close look also at the strategic communications world, which is almost like public relations on steroids. I mean, we're talking about a PR company, basically, a strategic communications firm that goes to a government and says, how much are you going to pay us to help you win the next election?
Yes, I mean, basically, the capacity to influence people to do what you want has become enormous, and the technology and the techniques involved in persuading people to do what you want have come on by leaps and bounds.
I mean, just going back to
since the past.
To the floods, for example, earlier this year, the Environment Agency have hundreds and hundreds of people actually just working full-time on public relations.
Yeah, and they won't be the only organisation so constituted. Persuading people outside the organisation of the organisation's goals and values is carried out by virtually every structure. I mean, virtually all, you know, if you're doing anything, you've got to persuade people to do what you want, and therefore you need people who are experts in persuasion, don't you?
Another thing, since the 1980s and 70s, is we've had a mass pool of unemployed people. I mean, what was Marx's view about that? Because quite a big change in society.
Well, I mean, this is fundamental, because, of course, what begins to happen is that labour is, as capitalism is a very constructive system, it comes up with lots of new ideas, it's constantly replacing labour. Now, that's why you need constant economic growth, because as people are replaced from old industries, they get absorbed into new industries as long as economic growth carries on. But, of course, capitalism can't guarantee economic growth. There are crises. There was one in the 1890s, one in the 1930s, one going on today, and suddenly you can't guarantee economic growth. The British economy is still smaller than it was before the crisis in 2008, and that means that, therefore, they can't provide enough jobs. Now, ultimately, you then have to think in terms of maybe it isn't through work that we're going to provide for people. So one of the positive things that might come out of the crisis is a really serious discussion of things like citizens' income, whereby people are guaranteed an income by society, and then they are encouraged to work on top of that income.
But we're in a situation now where we've got something like a permanent pool of something like 3 million, whatever the official figures say, maybe 4 million, unemployed people. I mean, how does that work to the advantage of the owners of society? Well, because it certainly isn't good for any of those people who are unemployed, is it?
No, well, what it does is it lowers the wages of those in work, which in theory increases the profit margin of the capitalists who are investing, which should encourage them to invest.
But does, of course, look good on the figures? I mean, the GNP maybe looks better, does
no,
it?
No, but got the ultimate unemployed. Problem with that is that ultimately one capitalist's employee is somebody else's consumer. So every individual company is trying to reduce the wage bill of its employees, but the wage bill of other people's employees those people are your customers. And this, of course, is what Keynes famously pointed out in the 30s. And this is why austerity doesn't work, because the more you cut, the less money is people's pockets, and therefore the less money there is to be spent.
I mean, is there any chance of full employment? Is there going
to?
Is that
I
gonna
don't
happen?
Think we're going to have full
it
employment.
Is it just not a policy anymore?
I think that they've decided that it isn't a policy. I mean, we haven't been pursuing a full employment policy in this country probably since the late 70s and the early 80s.
They're saying to disabled earlier. People, for example, we've heard that there are literally tens of thousands of disabled people who have been affected by the bedroom tax, now can't pay their rent properly, for example. Surely the idea behind that is to get them into work.
I think the idea behind that is simply to create a diversion so that people got somebody else to blame apart from the bankers. They're not going to save any money from it. The idea that we are now poor because the work ethic has gone away is just silly. We are now poor because the people at the top made a big miscalculation about the way in which stock markets would work if they were deregulated.
Because they didn't necessarily make a miscalculation because they made a fortune.
Ah, well, that's another question. How much of this is just stupidity and mistakes, and how much of it is quite deliberate policy? And I think there is quite strong evidence that there's quite a lot of deliberate policy behind all of this. Ruling classes do, in fact, get together in big conclaves like Bilderberg and decide what we're going to do. Well, we're going to try and drive wages down all over the world, etc., etc. But, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get what they want. The real world is very, very intractable. As I said, an asteroid could turn up tomorrow and kill us all. And there's no guarantee that the ruling class, which has basically pushed this agenda, they've rolled back the social gains of World War II. That has been quite a clear policy. That's what this has all been about in our adult lifetimes, Tony, to roll back those social gains.
And what about, I mean, we're constantly told to look at the growth figures, GMP, the money supply, these various ways of measuring the economy. I can remember years ago, we used to hear all the time about the balance of payments, mm-hmm. the amount of goods and services flowing in and out of the country. We don't hear much about that anymore, but we do hear a lot about GMP. Is there a difference between these various things that we're told, and is one pushed and another not?
Well, yes. I mean, there are fads and fashions. But I mean, the reason why we used to hear about the balance of payments, and it was so important, because the Bretton Woods system depended on that. So that because the currencies were fixed, the problems in the system would show up as balance of payments problems. Now, Britain still, in fact, imports far more than it exports. But of course, as long as we can borrow the money to cover that, it's not an issue. Under the Bretton Woods system, you'd have had to have made some kind of adjustment. If you were importing more than you exported, you'd have had to devalue the currency possibly, but you'd have had to have negotiated. That would have been a negotiation between governments about, we need to devalue our currency, are we going to be allowed to? Now what happens is with the international capital flows moving around every day, and far more money moves through the markets every day than is produced in the economy in a year. The derivatives market is now at least 12 and possibly many times bigger than the real economy. That is absolutely mad. That should never have been allowed to happen. And of course, when that market crashes, it's going to be catastrophic for many ordinary people.
Now, call me cynical, but I wonder if whether the rises in GMP are actually reflecting some pain actually on the ground with ordinary people.
Well, there isn't any rising GMP. This is the problem. The most successful growth period for the capitalist economy was in the Bretton Woods period from 1940 to 1973. And that was the kind of, you know, we were taught at university in the late 70s, we've basically cracked this now. We know what to do.
So what happened in the mid-70s?
Well, there are various versions of this. One version of this is that the workers got too greedy and they were demanding too many wage increases. I don't think that was true. What actually happened was that there is that Hyman Minsky is a dead economist now, but he pointed out that when a successful capitalist system will always run into a constraint, which is that when everybody thinks it's really great and they all start investing, they all overinvest. They invest far too much money in new possibilities of production than the market can absorb. And don't forget, all of the work, especially when you've not got strong trade unions and so on, as we've not had in the last generation, that isn't soaked up by more wages. this was the great advantage of having strong trade unions, as they used to do in Sweden, is that all productivity advantages are soaked up as wage increases. But that means that the workers have still got the money to buy back what they've been producing. If you force down wages all over the world, ultimately there isn't enough demand to buy what's been produced. The workers can't buy back what they've produced as a collectivity. So that is a real problem. And of course, they're now trying to talk about rebalancing demand in the global economy. But the way demand is rebalanced is ultimately through crashes, wars, social chaos, and then you start again from scratch. Now, I don't know whether the human society can actually tolerate that. I mean, if you think about the last big breakdown of capitalism in the 30s and the 40s, it ended up with 55 million dead in the Second World War. Then we thought we'd cracked it, which was basically to have a capitalist economy, but with lots of market, lots of government intervention to steer it. We gave up on the government intervention. We had a silly boom created by money printing, and now it's crashed, and we're back to square one. But we're not quite back to square one. The fact is that we're very close to the edge here now. We're very close to the edge where the whole thing could very easily just collapse. Very silly to have got ourselves into this position.
Yeah, we're doing quite a lot of looking back at World War II, but the thing is, if you look forward, I mean, we're in a possible nuclear situation if there is another large conflagration. Is there actually any use in looking at World War II as and the economics and the run up to it? I mean, what was that really all about? Was it simply that the 1929 crash happened in 1929, bubbled along for a while, and caused a war? Is it that simple?
I think you could make a strong case for suggesting that. Yes, effectively, the system broke down, and a new system emerged from the breakdown. We are at a similar inflection point now. The system which was put in place from 1979 to 2008 has broken down, but we haven't got a new system in place because essentially the power, the forces of, that are at work are still locked in combat, and it's not quite clear who's dominating the situation.
Now we're going to hear some music now from the war, from Italy. A song called Bella Ciao. Do you want to just put it in context, Martin, as to, you know, what was going on and who was singing? This is, I think I'm right in saying, an Italian partisan song.
This is the song of the Italian partisan movement, which was dominated by the PCI, the Partito Comunista Italiana, and they were the people who were prepared to fight Mussolini, etc., and this was their marching song. Bella Ciao means happy goodbye.
From the album Canti della Resistenza. Lots of surface noise on there, little crackly bits as well. And if you want to get hold of that album, it's wonderful stuff. It's on a De Vega label, D-E-V-E-G-A. Canti della Resistenza, that's RESTISTENZA, catalogue number DF1018. Martin, what was a partisan?
Well, I mean, there was an armed opposition to the Nazis and to Hitler in Italy, especially as the Allies were coming up from the south. The partisans, the Communist Party's most strongest support was in the north, and they were basically taking to the hills to fight against the fascist regime and their Nazi allies.
I mean, wasn't there also quite a strong partisan movement in the former Yugoslavia?
Yes, and they came to power at the end of the war with Tito and so on.
Now, I know that the British, the Special Operations Executive, did quite a lot of work, didn't they? Sort of parachuting in with Lysanders, yeah, and various other planes.
Fitzroy McLean made contact with Tito in the 40s, and the British effectively supplied the Yugoslav partisans with weaponry and intelligence and so on.
But there was, I think I'm right in saying that the right-wing partisans in Yugoslavia, Churchill began to support, but then they realised that they were actually not really the right people to support. I mean, it's quite a complex story, but I mean, we don't really seem to have a lot of our historical stuff nowadays really examining the massive resistance that there was across occupied Europe to the Nazis.
Well, there was. I mean, there are good books about this out there. I think what people fail to realise is that most of the problems that we face today in 2014 will have their roots in history for obvious reasons. But many people are surprised when things happen. For example, like the crash in 2008. I mean, if you've got enough historical perspective, that was pretty bound to happen.
But I mean,
so it's
surely
extraordinary that people were surprised.
I mean, in the past, surely those sorts of situations have ended up with banks crashing, people queuing up outside the banks, runs on the banks, and disaster, rather than the government then handing a massive load of cash, whatever it is, remember, hundreds of billions of pounds to the banks, saying it's going to be okay, there's some money to keep you going.
Well, that's the situation we've been in for the last few years. Is in the 30s, the state did not bail the banks out, so the banks were allowed to collapse, and then of course eventually the state decided to actually spend money into the society for its own purposes, to build, I don't know, tanks, guns, whatever. That's certainly what Hitler wanted to use the money for, and it's eventually what his opponents had to do as well. But what we've done here is we've bailed out the banks with taxpayer resources, and then we've just left them to go back to doing what they were doing previously and basically ripping off the system. And that has not actually been in the best interests of most of humanity.
Just looking up the figures here, Martin, in the Independent, an article on the 4th of December 2009 gives the final figure for the 2008 bailout as £850 billion. Now, that's nearly a trillion. It must have massively jacked up the national debt. We're in a pretty awful situation in that is almost certainly going to be not payable, that debt, even though they're still telling us, oh, one day we will pay it back.
Yeah, but that's the delusion, isn't it? I mean, I reluctantly supported the bailout of the banks in 2008 because I presumed that what would happen at that point is that everybody would realise that the free market philosophy of the previous 30 years was a load of rubbish.
You mean that they'd start, the Treasury would start actually running these banks?
Absolutely, and also you'd change your whole attitude towards what you were doing. We've really got it wrong here. We're going to have to start again, and we're going to have to throw all of this right-wing ideology out of the window.
It sounds like massive heist, almost.
It is a heist. That's exactly what it is. And what happened at that point is, having bailed the banks out, I mean, Milton Friedman and other right-wing economists would be opposed to bailing out the banks, they would be opposed to bailing out banks just as they'd be opposed to bailing out steel industries or shipbuilding industries, on the grounds that there's no point bailing out something which is basically on the way out. It's just, you know, you're just throwing money down the drain. Now, when it comes to things like steel industries, that might not be true, because if you bail them out, they might be able to turn themselves around.
Well, what about Rolls-Royce, for example? We've got an example here in Bristol.
Indeed, exactly. That's exactly what happened. But when you're talking about a banking system where it's basically being run fraudulently anyway, you then bail it out, and then not only do they carry on with the fraudulent activities they were doing previously, they use the profits from those fraudulent activities to buy the political process. Look at the funding of political parties. Where does it come from? Especially particularly in the US, but in Britain as well, it comes from the financial services industry. So the financial services industry gets its money from the government, then pays the political parties that it supports to carry on giving them the money so that they can carry on doing what they're doing. Nothing to do with Adam Smith or the free market. Nothing to do with the free market at all. The free market died in 2008.
Well, the British Bankers Association apparently has scores of full-time lobbyists, not just PR people to influence the press, but to directly lobby government for new laws that suit the city.
Yep, and that was pretty pernicious even before the bailout, because it allowed the deregulation of the market, which allowed the debt bubble to build, which then crashed. But of course, once you've bailed them out, you're giving them money, which they're going to use to lobby you to do the carry on doing the things they're doing, which of course is a very successful strategy if you're on the inside of it. Because the government is guaranteeing your profits, and then you're using those profits to buy the government to carry on guaranteeing your profits. The big fly in the ointment, of course, is that it's not sustainable. And when it crashes, it will crash.
At that point, and hopefully we can discuss this now before we get to that point, there will got to be some solutions, a plan B. Now, the obvious place to look is to Iceland, who've actually enforced the law, which we don't appear to have done here in Britain. The City of London Police, the Serious Organised Crime Agency, the Serious Fraud Office, not actually doing their job. But in Iceland, they have done their job. So what's your idea of a plan B, Martin?
Well, the obvious things to do is don't stop doing silly things, effectively. You've got to jettison the free market philosophy, and you've got to see the state as a necessary and inevitable participant in the economy. And that includes things like the commanding heights of the economy. Effectively, you're going to nationalise or bail out the banking system. It might as well be public. And at the very minimum, you could have a public banking system to compete with the private banking system. Now, in actual fact, if you had a public banking system, it would outcompete the private banking system quite easily, because the private banking system's bankrupt. And therefore, a new public system that wasn't bankrupt would be in a very strong position to get rid, just through competition, of the private banking system. And that's why it can't be allowed to happen. That's why a public banking system has not come out of the ashes of the crash of 2008. Because if a public banking system were to be created, it would crowd out the private sector. It would. You wouldn't need a private sector. The private sector would become unviable. Now, we're not allowed to think about that. The idea of a non-private banking system is a non-thought, and therefore we have to carry on with the policies we're pursuing, because it's got to be private. So the policy at the moment is that these banks will eventually be sold back to the private sector that are owned by the government. I can't see any prospect of that personally, and I don't think it'll ever happen. The crash will happen first, and then we'll realise that we've just wasted a load of money on feathering the nests of people in the Cayman Islands.
But since the Treasury don't seem to be doing it, what's your new deal? I mean, this is what Roosevelt had in the 1930s after the 29 crash. What's the new deal for today?
Well, the point is that in the 30s, instead of bailing the banks out, what they did is they used the resources to retool the economy and put people back to work. And then the banks were resurrected last of all, rather than first of all, if you see what I mean. What we've done is, instead of I think you should prop the banks up in the crash, and then you dismantle them effectively. But that's not what's happened. They've become zombie banks, ultimately dependent upon public subventions for their existence, and they've become more destructive since being bailed out than they were before they were bailed out. And that is a failure of the political system, because essentially there is no political will to discipline them.
Martin, I'm going to really chivvy you up here, because I want to know what your... I mean, we know that the system is broken. What are we going to do? I mean, for example, I know you've talked in the past about a citizen's income, making sure that every single person has got a basic income.
Yes, I would argue that that's
being looked at, isn't it, in Switzerland and Cyprus and elsewhere? And
I don't think it's going to come forward until we've had the crash, to be honest with you, because we're still stuck in capitalist think, where things are going to get better, we've just got to keep on in there. That delusion has got to go before people will start thinking in more radical ways. I mean, some people are thinking radically already, but the majority of the society isn't going to question this system until it really does become unviable.
I mean, sadly,
if we were smarter people, we would realise straight away that we were going to have to take steps in this direction.
I'm thinking about the Treasury almost as a kind of completely wholly owned subsidiary of the City of London, which it should be working for us.
Well, that's because therefore there's a tug of war, isn't there? I mean, there is no... In the 30s, don't forget, there was a communist movement, rightly or wrongly, which was pushing an alternative strategy. And that really put the pressure on. And you've got a fascist movement on the right pushing an alternative strategy as well. So that really puts the pressure on democratic politicians to come up with something. What we've lacked in this crisis is any alternative vision.
Well, ultimately, the
problem is, which instead of bailing the banks out, the money should have been used to retool the society with the banks only at the very end.
One positive thing in all of
that's not what we've done.
In all of this is that we've actually got a tremendous resource in a very well-educated population. A lot of young people that don't have a job right now are actually gagging to do that work. I mean, I think this idea of, oh, the young people are lazy is a complete and utter myth.
It's ridiculous.
I mean,
ridiculous.
You know, you're talking about scores and scores of people applying for every single job. And, you know, isn't that a resource that we can use?
Let's put it this way. The problem is this. In the 30s, the state had not bailed the banks out. Therefore, when the state decided to do things, it had the resources to do stuff because it hadn't bailed the banks out. What's happened this time is by bailing the banks out, the resources that the state could easily use to reboot the society have already been wasted. Now, those resources still exist. They're in the private bank accounts of the people who have benefited from the crisis. So ultimately, you could get that money off them and use it, but it's not actually, as we speak, in the hands of the state. In the 30s, the state was strong enough to be able to intervene. But the double bind we're in here is that the banking system has not only crashed the economy, but it's also managed to snaffle all the resources through which you might want to rebuild the economy. So in other words, the only route to recovery is via the banks getting things back on track. But the banks are never going to get things back on track because they're bust. Governments simply aren't strong enough, either financially or politically, to take them on. And that won't happen until, I'm afraid, we've had a major crash.
Well, there are campaigns around to reform the money system completely, yes. Root and branch. One yes. of them is positive money.
Yes, and I think those ideas of basically money creation isn't in the hands of the government. So the sort of monetarist revolution of the 1980s has been completely negated. The idea that the government should control the money supply, it's silly because the government doesn't control the money supply.
That's
it
right.
never
I mean,
really
one
did
of the, one of the
and
fundamental,
certainly doesn't now.
One of the fundamental questions they ask is, where does money actually come from? Who creates it and who decides how to spend it?
Well, it's basically the private banks are the money creators, with the government very much puffing along behind to try and keep up. And that did not used to be the case, but now it is.
Their fundamental thing is they believe that the power to create money should be taken away from the banks.
Yes, and therefore and put in the hands of the government. Now, the argument against putting it in the hands of the government is that the government's going to be under pressure to spend more than it earns in order to satisfy various constituencies that will be lobbying for whatever they want. But you could probably write the legislation in such a way that the government couldn't just print money. The idea is that the government should provide money into the society as a social good, just like it used to provide things like water and education. Now, can you see that we're so far away from that? Water and education aren't even provided by the government now, never mind money. And we've reached a situation where private ownership of all of these resources has been concentrated in the hands of a tiny elite. And studies have shown that this elite dominates the world economy, you know, that virtually all they've got cross ownership and so on. And they do, in fact, coordinate their activities.
So do we have any lessons to learn, finally, from Iceland here in Britain?
Yes, we do. But don't forget that the Icelanders have got away with it because they've basically dumped their debts onto other...
Well, can't we dump our debts onto
yes,
somebody
Yes, well, ultimately that's what will happen. Everybody will dump their debts. But at that point, that is a crash, basically. If everybody did what Iceland did, the thing would crash. And then you'd have to...
What if just Britain did it?
Well, if just Britain is actually at a central place in all of this. I mean, we're probably the most financially exposed of anybody. And we've got a situation where the British taxpayer is actually bailing out the international banking system, because the international banking system is headquartered in Britain. We are going to be at the heart of the crisis either way. But ultimately, we are going to have to change the way we do things. But unfortunately, until people get rid of this old thinking that the only way forward is the capitalist way, then I'm afraid we're not going to get very far. But ultimately, it's over. Capitalism is finished.
What's going to take its place?
Probably chaos and murder. I'm not a Marxist in the 19th century sense that believes, oh great, we've got a crisis of capitalism, this means capitalism will be gone and soon we will have a nice socialist society. most likely the collapse of capitalism will be like the collapse of the Maya civilization or the destruction of Atlantis. But we have got some hope. While there's life, there's always hope. And in actual fact, if we've got enough democratic resources and people who are willing to make enough sacrifices, maybe we can build a decent society for our grandchildren.
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, thank you very much. You've been listening to The Politics Show, a longer view than normal, a pre-recorded programme because I'm at the National Union of Journalists conference this week, and we're back to the normal schedule next week. So for the time being, thanks very much for joining us. Have a good weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'm Tony Gosling, and our website is at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll leave you with some music.
Under black mountains, in open spaces, by deep brown rivers that slither darkened, through farm arches, where the blue hair raises. Come with me to the Northern part is Western Child, where the dance of ages is playing still. Group our marches, our papers wild. I'll make love to you in narrow side streets, with shattered windows and crumbling chimneys. Come with me to the weary town, disco silent under tiles. The slide from rooftops scatters softly on concrete marches, our baker's wild. Bye.